This podcast is brought to you by the Common Mission Project.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Common Mission Project podcast series. Today, I have a very special guest with me, my colleague at the Common Mission Project, Ty Smith. Hi, Ty.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing today?
I wish this spring would go past as quickly as possible because my allergies are killing me. But other than that, I'm ready to go, man.
Yeah, it's the same thing here. So we're both struggling with some allergies. So if you hear some congestions or whatever along the way, it's just that time of the year. And I know you might be listening to this, you know, in the wintertime, whenever it comes, whenever you decide to get to it. But this should be a really exciting conversation. So Ty, you and I have been working together my whole time at Common Mission Project, and you've got a really unique role in the organization, and one that I think is should be exciting for everybody listening to us today. So what I want to kind of do is just give you an opportunity, just a little bit of your brief background and some things here, and then we'll jump into the topics we want to have. But Ty is, you know, we have nobody in the organization is uncritical, but some of the work that Ty has been doing, or all of it to me, is what's going to help propel Common Mission Project into the future, but not only Common Mission Project, our partner ecosystems that we're working very closely with. And I think this is such an important area of partnership and collaboration that Ty has been working on, that we really felt this is an opportunity for Ty to talk about some of the work that he's been spearheading, and then ways that you can get involved as you're listening to this. Because one of the most important parts of the ecosystem that we've cultivated over a number of years is that involvement with our faculty, with our universities, with private partnerships. And this is an area that Ty is, you've spearheaded in a huge way for us. So Ty, just a little bit about your background and what you've been doing and what you're up to.
So thank you. So this is now a year and a half into my association with Common Mission Project. Prior to that, I spent 15 years supporting the intelligence community, particularly at the National Geospatial Intelligence Community, where I did things like executive coaching, business model innovation, strategy, team development, those kinds of things. And so I come to Common Mission through my association or previous association with Steve Blank, who, as we all know, is the gentleman who started the Lean Launchpad, which became ICOR, and now Hacking for Defense. And so I am really excited to be here. I come here in my role as the Director of Strategic Partnerships. So what do I mean by that? There is a gentleman at MIT who talks about strategic innovation ecosystems, Dr. Phil Budden. Mm-hmm. And Phil has this idea that if you have at the center of your ecosystem a problem or an opportunity, what are the constituent parts of the ecosystem that you can bring to bear to solve that problem? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like McKinsey's 5S models.
Right.
And so even before I knew Dr. Budden and knew who he was, I was thinking in that direction because, you know, that's just how my brain works.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense.
So I'm not the, I am the 1 + 1 + 1 = 111 guy, right? It's not sequential. It is exponential in the way that I think. Sometimes it's useful. Other times it gets me into trouble. But in this case, it's actually useful. And so I think of my ecosystem as a problem, you know, Common Mission Project that is problem centric, unlike ICOR, which is dual tech centric,
right?
Or dual use centric, excuse me, mm-hmm. being problem centric. So if I put the problem at the center, we at Common Mission bring to bear a number of schools to say, we're going to teach you this methodology. We're going to present you with this opportunity to solve a problem. And so what I do at a more strategic level, say, so who do we need to help make these students who the mission of Common Mission Project or the vision is to create mission-centered or mission-focused entrepreneurs,
right,
to address hard problems. And so I think in terms of government, it could be civilian, NASA, it could be Department of Energy, Interior, or the DODIC. You know who those characters are.
Absolutely.
It could be public nonprofit, a public-private partnership. It could be fully nonprofit. It could be the corporate environment. It could be venture capital, if we could ever get to that point. And so we bring them all together and say, how do we address this? And I think in terms of beginning, middle, and end, those of you that know the Lean startup, the Lean Launchpad opportunity, you start to address a problem. You think about desirability. Does somebody want to build it? Can we begin to build it and iteratively, and then eventually, what's the viability path? Mm-hmm. In other words, can we scale this thing?
Right.
And so My job is to think in terms of not the schools. There, Jim, you helped to create the curriculum and to codify and curate the curriculum. We have other folks who actually do the assessment. But my job is to go outbound, not on the government side, but on the outbound side, like I characterized in the ecosystem, to say, who do I get to bring them along? I'm not necessarily involved in the beginning part, which is the education part, but the outbound part. We have something called our Impact Fund, where we have opportunities for students who go, yep, this hasn't made me so crazy that I want to quit and, you know, and run away as quickly as possible.
Right, crawl into a hole.
But exactly. But there might be some that'll say, you know, there's actually something to this. We have a set of money set aside that we can help fund these students. And so in the outbound, we give them a little bit of seed capital. In the venture capital community, this would be very, very pre-seed, but it's non-dilutive. In other words, we aren't expecting any equity out of that. Mm-hmm. And so we give them the money. But what we're trying to do is train them in a way that by the time they do have something that hopefully is scalable and they do go for equity-based funding, they know how to do it.
Right.
So they're very smart. They're very smart in how to do this. And we've had, you know, some successes, the biggest of which is Capella Space,
right?
If anybody knows Capella Space, those their last set of funding, I think, was Series D, and it was like $92 million.
Yeah.
And I know it's well over $1 billion valuation. And so we're very, very left of $1 billion valuation, very, 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 very far left. And so that's what I do. And then my other set of the mission is to bring in historically Black colleges and universities. There are 106 of those. They're also what we call MSIs, minority serving institutions, Hispanic serving institutions, PBIs are predominantly Black institutions. They're Asian serving institutions. There are over of that MSI community to include HBCUs is 700. Yeah, there's a humongous number, tribal colleges, I forgot, tribal college universities. How do we introduce them into this very dynamic ecosystem of mission-focused entrepreneurship? And so I spend a lot of time talking to folks, calling them up, connecting the dots, and seeing what I can do. It's my job.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's one of the things, you know, I was fortunate before I came on the Common Mission Project that I got to start working with you before I was officially part on board to start like hypothesizing around the Lean Educators conference that we had in the wintertime, which was an incredible event. And then, one of the things that actually, Ty, that was really, really fun for me is when we met in person for the first time, we had our CMP international team come through. So our team in Australia, the team in the UK come, and Ty led a team building event over the course of 3 days. And I've done a lot of these, whether it was in the military and corporate America, and I've never participated in a better run event than the one that Ty did. I've never walked out of one of these events where I thought I got something out of this in such a both exciting and humbling way. So, you know, what's great with working about you, Ty, for me is the excitement you bring to all of this. And I mean, you do have an educational background. You do teach. You are working with these institutions where that we know as educators, diversity is hugely important for so many different reasons. And this is one of the reasons that I'm really excited about having you. One of the many reasons having you on for a conversation is because the work that you're doing to me is a representation of what societally we have been pushing for, but we're putting structure to this because that underrepresentation in these institutions means that we're not getting the ideas to solve critical problems because we're not having that diversity of thought and background in a more inclusive way. And that to me is one of the next turning points we have as in academia is this combination of being able to not just academia, but just a society to bring in these diverse thoughts. And that's to me is a very, very exciting prospect as an educator. And just like, I think maybe just as a person to see, well, what are these students bringing to the table and how are we facilitating their success? That's exciting.
Yeah. It really is. So I have a... So my W-2 job is the Director of Strategic Partnerships. I have other things that I do that are both some paid and a whole bunch of other things that aren't paid.
Right.
And one of those unpaid is I'm on the board of the National Advisory Board for the Manufacturing Extension Partnerships for the NIST, National Institutes of Standards and Technology.
Right.
So some of your listeners will be familiar with the CHIPS Act. The CHIPS and Science Act Which it's interesting because most people hear chips, but they don't hear the science part.
That last bit, right?
Yeah, mostly because they go, "Oh my God, we're gonna throw money to secure the semiconductor supply chain. It's $40 billion. It's a $52 billion bill that got passed through the House, the Senate, and went to the president's desk and signed." Mm-hmm. And I've learned these words lately. It has been authorized, but not necessarily appropriated. But the money is going out, right?
Right.
And so my very first meeting of the MEP, Manufacturing Extension Partnerships National Advisory Board, they went around and he said, "Who are you?" And I'm like, "My name is Ty Smith, Common Mission Project, and I don't know anything about manufacturing." I was just up front. I know nothing about manufacturing. And everybody laughed. But I said, "What I do know is the importance of a workforce development that includes people that you would normally not see."
Right.
So in other words, where's the diversity?
Right.
Because honestly, and I said this to them, that it's a national security issue.
Absolutely.
It's a national security issue. And so as the current scientific leadership administrative body that's up there, so we're talking about if you're in the government, you're a GS 14, 13, 14, 15 SES. Mm-hmm. As that community gets grayer and less white, if we don't have people in the pipeline, in the workforce pipeline to back that up, you don't have to wait for the Chinese to do anything.
Right.
You just wait us out.
Right, exactly. Right?
Because we don't have, to your point, the diversity. And so diversity to me is not just a nice thing to do. It's not, do we have enough black people, enough gay people, enough straight people? It's like, do we have enough people to make sure that we can compete? Mm-hmm. At an international level, not just a national, but at an international level.
Sure.
Exactly. In such a way that we understand that it is not just that we are, as Steve Blank will say, this is a global competition, mm-hmm. right? It's the third offset, I think they call it, the third offset or fourth offset, one of those.
Yeah, something
it's
like
the
that.
Latest offset, right? Mm-hmm. So you have state actors that we know about. And if you don't do something to counter that groupthink is overused, but to counter a groupthink idea, mm-hmm. you're going to get lost. Because diversity, what does it mean? The data, the scientific data would suggest that when you have diverse decision makers in a room, they think they did it with one study I saw was a jury, mm-hmm. a jury pool. And so if you have diverse people on your jury pool, you'll have a better jury decision than if you have everybody looks the same.
Right.
Extend that to organizational dynamics. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It happens in the same way. And so I am very much attuned to what it means to have diverse thinkers, to have diverse opportunity, to have diverse smarts on a team, in an organization, in an ecosystem that can deliver against really hard problems, i.e. what we do at Common Mission.
Absolutely. And this is the thing with running teams and the H4 experience, for example, where diversity means a lot of different things now. And to your point, it's not just a race issue or a gender or a sexual identity. It's none of those. It's the combination of all these different factors and backgrounds and everything else. And, you know, I'm running a Wicked Problems course this semester, and I know, Ty, you know this. And what's interesting for me is having a lot of different backgrounds, because if you're talking, we use the infrastructure bill, and we're talking about different things coming up. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have students that are coming from Mississippi and a student that's from New York versus California, the way that they look at, for instance, transportation or accessibility is going to be inherently different because of their experiences. And this, to me, it's diversity means so much. And it's not diversity for the sake of diversity. It's because your experiences are going to direct you into a different path, and you're going to be able to inform stakeholders in a more broad way because of what you do. Everyone brings value to a problem. And I think that's the underlying theme that I really try to talk to my students about. But when you go and have these experiences as a team, or being able to go into a diverse situation, you start to realize the value that everybody brings to whatever it is they're working on. And I think that, to me, is one of those student experiences that it's not, it's not that they're blind to what's around them. They just haven't had the exposure. Well, exposure and empathy, which is, I think, a key tenet of the things that we're trying to build, will enable us to build partnerships that can facilitate this really robust problem solving. that doesn't happen with groupthink, to your point, Ty. And it doesn't happen if everybody looks or thinks the same, because it's those experiences, those very ingrained growing up opportunities that those students had or those individuals had that shapes who, so much of who they are. We need those individuals to have a voice. Well, how do we do that? And that's a lot of the work that you've been tackling.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I've been listening to a podcast. I'm about to direct a conference. It's a very different kind of conference than we would normally think about standing up presenting papers. And so, but I've been trying as the director to put the conference in mind.
Right.
And so I'm listening to a couple of podcasts, and I was listening to a podcast about psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This kind of conference that it is. I'm not a psychoanalyst by any stretch of the imagination, but I understand psychoanalytic principles.
Right. You're a social scientist enough to understand.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. The one cast that I was listening to today, it was the gentleman who helped to negotiate the Northern Ireland Accords.
Right.
Right. He helped solve this problem, the Good Friday Accords. Exactly. Right. And he talked about getting people, a diverse set of people, mostly diverse there was Northern Ireland and the Brits, right? And right. trying to bring them together.
Contextually, sure.
But so you just said the right word. You just said the right word. It's diversity in context. It is disagreement in context. It is ideas in context. If you don't allow people to have context, no matter what they bring, and bring their context forward, I really love the idea of infrastructure. So if you look at Jackson, Mississippi.
That's a great example.
There you go. Predominantly Black town. We know Jackson, Mississippi. Some of you all and your listeners may know Jackson State. That were Deion Sanders. That was there.
Yep.
Their water system is the worst, one of the worst in the country. Almost as bad as what's happening in Flint, Michigan. You have Flint, Michigan. What's going on in there?
What's going on in Flint, Michigan? Yep, absolutely.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You have what's going on in like Philadelphia, but then you think about water in infrastructure in California. Now it's a little different, but back when this infrastructure project got signed up, they didn't have any water.
Right.
They were dry as a bone.
Right.
Exactly. And so if you don't bring context to the conversation, you will only have your context if you are the one trying to solve the problem. You only have your context to work from.
Right.
But that's also hard if you're trying to bring this change, but you don't, and you bring other people in, but you don't allow them to bring their context. You can then say, I had diverse people here. You had diverse people. You did not have diverse context.
Exactly. And I think that's a critical piece of all of this is that diverse context. And this is where, you know, and it's been in the news a lot about, you know, the attacks against, you know, DEI and these different things. And it really, there's points that are missing out of all the conversation. And I think we have to get into that intellectual aspect of it because we all look the same or we all look different. But if we're all coming from, we all went to Harvard and we all did this or whatever, that's the contextual elements there are missing. And I think this is one of the predominant parts where we really have to have diverse thought. And one of the, again, going back to like in a classroom experience that I remember thinking, well, this person is just a whatever. And as you get older, and I'm grateful to have had this smack in the hands, early on, is that I don't care what you do. You can be the person who's the custodian. You can be the tenured faculty. None of these things work unless you have those individuals doing their jobs really well. So what does that mean? No one person is more important than another. And we have to embrace the roles that we have, do them well to facilitate everything else happening. That's a message I tell my students, and they start to see that because like, well, this person, and again, I hate using this word, but contextually it matters. Oh, they're just an administrator. Yeah, but they're running the organization. They're the ones who are providing the reports and providing insights. So there's no just. These are individuals that have an equal stake in everything that's going on. And that diversity, again, contextually is extremely important for people to understand throughout the problem solving process because it goes to the heart of what we've talked about. What problem are we really trying to solve? And if we're using infrastructure as a real one, I mean, if we're looking at these, what's the similarity between Flint, Michigan and Jackson, Mississippi? I mean, I don't have to be any kind of genius to say, well, what's the common denominator here? And this is like that wicked idea, the wicked problems idea is, again, it's layers and layers. So there's so much there, but you can look at, well, what's an underlying factor? Where's the commonalities? And you can dive into that rabbit hole pretty easily. This is why diversity of thought contextually with individuals from those backgrounds coming together to solve problems, to me, is so fundamentally important to us being a nation that does have a path forward.
So it's interesting you would say that. So I referenced the conference that I'm about to direct. One of the primary frameworks that we use is something called BART, Boundaries, Authorities, Roles, and Tasks, right?
Okay.
And BART was developed by two of my colleagues. And the idea is it's based on this notion of the BART system in California.
Right.
Gets you from one side of the bay to the other.
Right.
And so when you are, and I love the idea that you bring in task and role, because again, that's two parts of it.
Right.
When you don't have a task as the centralizing concept, if we don't agree on holding task as the centralizing, we end up doing recriminations. If only they would.
Right. Yeah.
I can't do this. Mm-hmm. Those people are. Right. And so we devolve to our most basic ways of behaving. Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely.
And so it is a projection outside. But when you have task and you understand the power of role, right?
Absolutely.
If you understand the power of the authority in the role, you understand boundaries. What's mine? What ain't mine? What's yours? What ain't mine? And mm-hmm. we agree on that. Task becomes central, becomes a centralizing principle that you can do this. And so for me, when I think about my role in CMP as the director of strategic partnerships, and I think about the task, it makes it very easy. If I hold the task, it makes it very easy for me to go to a corporate venture capital person or somebody who is an executive, a high-flying executive at a corporation, mm-hmm. to say things like, and I've done this, so we're able to thank our partner Lockheed Martin to
Absolutely.
Say, I need some extra money.
Yep.
You funded us in the past. I need some extra money because I have this right. I have this other part. And there you go. What do you want to do with it? This is what I'm trying to do.
Right.
Because your task is this. And I'm very clear on what you're trying to do.
Absolutely.
I'm very clear on what our task is. I need the money to be able to make this happen. They were like, no problem.
Yeah.
Got it. And I know I'll be able to do it with other organizations as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is where some of the things that you've been doing, and along with our colleague Eric Pereca, is, you know, bringing this in. So you mentioned, you know, with Lockheed Martin, for example, I had, and this is my university at RIT is not unique, but those impact funds facilitated students going to do the site travel, the visit with the sponsoring organizations.
Yes.
What other kind of opportunity do the students have to be able to do that when, you know, the funding's going to be limited? And we're talking about, you know, with the universities in the particular that you're working with, there isn't money there all the time to do things, even where I am. So having these gifts facilitates so much. One more example is I had my student team go present to Congress very recently because the awesome. Impact funds facilitate being able to do that. So you're talking about, not only is it life-changing for us as facilitators, but think about the student who is standing in the rotunda at Capitol Hill or meeting with somebody in the Department of Defense and having a life-changing experience. And this is where, you know, again, we're going on a tangent here, but this is something that's so important to that experience.
It's interesting that you would offer this up because two things I want to talk about. One is access. As the person who is trying to make sure that we bring in more HBCUs into the ecosystem. There is, and the other one is about access, purely access, mm-hmm. right, on the back end.
Right.
And so just getting the HBCUs in is interesting because it's not about their capability.
Right.
There are plenty of capable professors, PhD. A PhD, if you got your stuff and you're publishing, mm-hmm. and you're a PhD, guess what? You're a PhD. It doesn't matter.
Right. Yes.
But if you are a PhD at a HBCU, it comes to capacity.
Yes.
It's a capacity issue where capacity is measured in time. Capacity is measured in focus. Capacity is measured in resources, right? Mm-hmm. And financial yep. resources.
Right.
I'll give an example. I'm going to use RIT as a research two institution.
Yep. We're an R2.
And R2 and Delaware State, which was just recently one of eight schools to include Howard University, to be awarded the Air Force's latest university-affiliated research center, UARC. There are only now 15 of these institutions, or 15 of these research centers around the country, first one at an HBCU.
Which is incredible.
Yeah. Oh, trust me, it is.
Yeah.
So Delaware State, they are a DoD center of excellence in quantum sensing, right? Lots of capability.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the issue. They are also an R2 university, you know, high research university, just like RIT.
Right.
RIT's endowment is $1 billion as of when I looked at it, I think it was 2021-22. That mm-hmm. was their endowment. Delaware State, another R2, their endowment was $40 million.
Just a slight difference. Just slight.
just slight. And it's not to begrudge the success in terms of being able to put stuff out for RIT, but it speaks to the level of what you can do in terms of capacity. And so you either teach, you do research, or you're fundraising.
Right.
There's no blend in between, and there's no capacity at the university level to help support that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to go to a corporate partner and say, hey, listen, this I need your help to create capacity, not capability,
right.
Capacity.
And I think that right? distinction is really important. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so I need your support. I need your help. It could be a financial support. It could be institutional support, you know, name company X. It could be mentoring, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever that might be. And so that's one. The other thing that I think is important, that once we get them in, having students to have the ability to be able to see things, to go to Capitol Hill, for instance.
Right, right.
I found a peer review article by, I don't know how you pronounce it, it was PHYC, phys.org. It's a peer review. They talked about startups, mm-hmm. which eventually the program that we have on the outbound for our students is they have the potential to make a startup, like we mentioned earlier in the yeah. in the conversation.
Right, at Capella Space.
Yes. If you look, the data would suggest, I think it was 4,000 data points. If at the early stage, if you look the part, you get money.
Mm-hmm.
At Series C and B and C, if you know the stuff, you get the money.
Right.
Now, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that problem? In terms of pattern recognition,
right.
at the early, if you don't look like it, you don't get in.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if you get in, it's going to take you a while to get the money. I had a colleague from another one of those, one of our corporate, our strategic partners that we're trying to work with to get some of these students exposed
mm-hmm.
At the other university. He said, hey, Ty, listen, I got this young lady. She's a bad dude. I mean, she's a bad girl. She's a bad girl. Yeah. Not a dude. Bad girl. Right. I want you to talk to her because she's having trouble finding money. I'm like, okay.
Right.
Here's the situation. PhD, postdoc in biomechanical engineering out of an Ivy, figured out a way to utilize AI and sensing to do a very, very specific medical procedure. Right.
Okay.
Very necessary.
Right. Understood.
But could not find $10,000 to start her business.
Which is a rounding error for a lot of these places, right? For these VCs or whatever. It's nothing.
But yet the VCs will fund a dormitory idea.
Mm-hmm.
If you look the part, you get money. Doesn't matter how much you, how good or your technical skills are, how much, you know, the work that you've done. And so in my role, it's not just, I don't see it just as an institutional, let's go find more, you know, HBCUs and MSIs and blah, blah, blah. It is a culture shift. It is shifting the environment. It is shifting the way that we perceive the work.
Absolutely.
How people do the work. Who's mm-hmm. available? Who has the skills? Who has the requisite whatever?
Right.
And so I get excited about it. I get passionate by it. Because I think it is, again, diversity ain't just a nice thing to do. It's a national security thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, your passion for this rubs off on everybody you talk to. And it has for me, right? And I mean, this is something that I think as an educator, something I care about just inherently. But being able to have, again, these kind of conversations. And when Ty and I were talking about, again, like that endowment difference, it's, we have to look at things more holistically, like design thinking pieces of all this. But there's so many elements in here that you're helping to address in a systematic way and bringing in the partners who are also excited about this. So I think that that's where we, again, it's not a nice to have, it is a must. And it's a must in so many different ways for all the reasons that we've been talking about. And again, you want to see it. You want to see these student teams where there's diverse, you know, majors, backgrounds, whatever. We can show you that. We can show you the evidence of having these students come together and never having worked together and building these partnerships and these lifelong friendships because they learn so much from each other. And I think that's one of the things I loved about the Army, honestly, was that there's, you know, when I was an infantry guy, we brought together people from every race, religion, you know, creed, whatever. And being able to have those, that diversity there to me is one of the things that I loved about the Army. Now, Army has its problems and we know that, but, you know, being able to work with somebody who wasn't like me, that wasn't like I grew up with, that gave me a worldview that I wouldn't have been able to have otherwise. Same thing with teaching and working, Ty, working with you is when you find individuals who are passionate about the same thing that you are, but bringing in a different element, that's where you start to see these overlap opportunities and these types of excitement, these type of exciting opportunities that wouldn't have, the doors wouldn't have opened to me otherwise. So that to me is just revelatory in so many different ways.
Yeah, I think that the thing that holds, you have to respect the military, particularly after Truman desegregated.
Right.
And a buddy of mine who's a Marine, he said, even the Marine Corps has like light green and dark green Marines, right? That's the way they were able to differentiate, right? Kind of tongue in cheek, light green and dark green. But the fact is that task, what were we here to do?
Yes.
That was the rallying cry. Mm-hmm. When you have clarity of the task, the rest of it makes sense. You can figure out like who does what, division of labor, you know, who's the authority, where's leadership come from. When you lose task, that's when it goes sideways.
I absolutely agree. Yep.
And task is again contextual. It is culturally unspoken parts of task is that I come with a task, my understanding of how to do task, you come with yours. But when we lose the capacity to dialogue around it for clarity, good luck.
Yep, that's it. You've lost the plot.
Yep.
100%.
Good luck. Absolutely. So
there's a couple of other things I want to talk about, Ty, with you. One of the next one was commercialization. And this is an area that you know better than I do. So there's definitely some deference there that I'm going to have in this part of the conversation. But I want to talk a little bit about commercialization and some of the things that you've been seeing around there and the things that you've been working towards to facilitate commercialization.
So I am in no way an expert, right? What I've been doing is taking notice of what it means to do commercialization. I had the privilege about 3 weeks ago now to go to Cleveland to be the master of ceremonies for the Federal Laboratory Consortium's awards, national awards ceremony. Mm-hmm. The federal labs are a consortium of 300 laboratories, about one third, two third unclassified DOD kinds of laboratories all over the country. Anything from high energy physics all the way down to looking at snails or whatever, right?
Right.
Biological right. labs, right?
Yeah, the whole spectrum.
The whole spectrum and science. What that entire 2 days was about, actually 2.5 days was about, was them trying to figure out how do we get stuff off the shelf and out and commercialized. There are innumerable amounts of product that's sitting on the shelf because scientists are scientists, right? They just like making stuff.
Yeah, build it. But
they're not okay. Exactly. They're not concerned about how do we transfer it from off the shelf and do something with it in terms of commercialization. One way to think about commercialization is Tang and Velcro, right?
Oh, yeah.
They were developed in the lab for a particular issue, but they were able to make it out of the laboratory environment into a commercialized space. Mm-hmm. And so the folks at NASA, the folks at NSA, the folk at NGA, the folks at Oak Ridge, all of these laboratories are struggling with how do we make space for this stuff to come out of our laboratories and so it makes it into commercial space. Mm-hmm. I've gotten a sense of what it means to potentially blend my role in terms of HBCUs and strategic partnerships with what that might mean for the laboratory and trying to bring them together. Maybe I have this ecosystem of what that understands. Oh, not to mention my NIST role. NIST has right. a whole smattering of stuff, particularly in the advanced manufacturing, advanced and additive manufacturing, as well as 5G, you know, quantum, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Right. And so they don't have it all. They don't quite get it, right?
Right.
Because part of that is we want to do commercialization, but it has to have a pathway to make that happen. And so what I'm trying to figure out, and I would love any one of your listeners that might pick this up. What I'm trying to figure out is what's the right path? And it's not just me. Some people I've talked to are decision makers at any one of these government organizations. They're trying to figure out, so how do we do? They understand the legal process on their side,
right?
But how do you work with a venture firm that's like, I got money and I need product, but I need to know that that somebody's going to carry the product through, because mm-hmm. we don't build it. We got to do it in a different way. Mm-hmm. There are a number of different opportunities. Steve Blank just dropped a article about venture studios, which is a very different pathway of doing, developing ideas.
Right.
We talk about our students in what happens with them. Some of the students come out of your class, Jim, and say, Professor Santa's crazy. I'm going back and finish my degree.
Right,
I'm out. You know, lost his mind. That's way too much money for me. I mean, too much time for me. Some will, on the opposite end, like, I'm dropping out of school. I'm going to go and develop my own business. But there'll be some in the middle that'll say, you know what? My idea didn't work, but I'm willing to try something different.
Yes.
I'm willing to try on somebody else's. And so this idea of commercialization, there are plenty of folks. I've been talking to some folks at one of the ARPAs, just the ARPAs, not designating which one, because there's right. energy, there's health, there's DARPA, which is defense, IARPAs, which is intelligence. I'm actually going to have a conversation with their director soon about this idea of HBCUs and what it might mean for their participation with ARPA, mm-hmm. with IARPA. But they are trying to figure out, how do we get our stuff off of the shelf? One hypothesis could be, Jim, you have a couple of students, you know, their projects stank, but they've got the entrepreneurship bug. What would it look like? A little design thinking in the moment.
Okay.
Human-centered design. What would it look like to say to them, hey, this CMP, BMNT, H4X lab, blah, 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 whatever combination actually has a venture studio in conjunction with a government lab that mm-hmm. has some data, has some product out there that they need you to support and grow into a business. Are you willing to do that? Dude, that could be crazy.
Absolutely. They've already won through the process. They already have an understanding of what they would need to start with. So that's already out of the way.
So, and as you say that, I've played with some ideas and tested it with some venture capital folks that have said, we will teach people business. We will teach them the business, right? They come to us with an idea. The problem that we have is they come to us with something that has no product market fit. It's just a really good idea.
That hasn't been validated even yet.
Exactly. Has mm-hmm. no market validation, has no problem solution fit market validation, the hypotheses, the experiments, they haven't done that piece. If you guys could teach them how to do it, well, we'd be all right then.
Yeah.
We might be in business and we Absolutely. Might work with you.
Yeah.
And so I see that kind of conversation in my role as a part of those commercialization, as a part of those strategic partners that I talked about at the very beginning of our conversation. Mm-hmm. How do we develop those strategic partners in such a way that we take students from entre what? I think I keep spelling it wrong because spell check gets it to the end. We're like, I am now Capella
what word
Space.
Is this? Yeah.
Exactly. What does this thing mean? To the point where you get a Capella Space where they're like, yeah, we're about to go for Series A, Series B.
Yes.
You know, so that's how I think about it.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, this is a good segue into one of the last topics here before we close out the episode, is this idea of tech transfer. And that really obviously intertwines quite well with the idea of commercialization. So this is also an area that you have a lot of intimate experience and drive with.
Yeah, tech transfer is, it's hard because either for the organizations like NASA and NSA, because that's part of, that's where the stuff comes out of, they have tech transfer departments. But what's really interesting is at the university level. So let's do a little hypothesis. So RIT, Rochester Institute of Technology, all the stuff that's coming out, obviously you all are doing well with tech transfer, because one of the outputs of tech transfer is wealth building for the university, for the institution. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea how big your department is, right? How you big your tech transfer. But for HBCUs, that's another capacity issue.
Absolutely.
So my oldest son goes to the largest HBCU in the country. They produce more African-American engineers than any university combined per year, right?
Right.
We're putting out like 2,000 of jokers a year.
Yeah,
right?
No joke. Absolutely.
No joke. They're just pushing them out. Qualified engineers that are just killing it. They raised, I think they did 2 years ago, they did $100 million in government fundraising, right? They raised $100 million. They got 8 patents awarded, which is kind of crazy, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Here's their tech transfer capacity. They have a vice president for institution or vice president for research, and they have one person doing tech transfer.
One.
In a school that had 8 patents awarded, $100 million in government fundraising, went crazy. They have one person. I know who she is. I went and I said, so talk to me about a school of similar size and what their department may look like. She said, East Carolina and Appalachian State, they have 5 and 6 people.
Wow. So yeah, order of magnitude more.
Order of magnitude more. A&T was considered the fourth best university by some measures in North Carolina. You had Duke, North Carolina Chapel Hill, and NC State, and then you had A&T, but they got one. It's a capacity issue.
It's a capacity issue, yeah.
So to do all that research, do it. But to get that research and to transfer it to the corporate so it becomes commercializable, we got work to do.
Yeah.
We got plenty of work to do.
And this is where what I'm hoping when people are listening is they get as passionate about this as Ty and I are, because the opportunity here to bring in these universities that we know have an output of incredible graduates, this is an opportunity for us to kind of almost like it's a ground floor opening, because we've recognized, again, just by this one example that Ty gave, we recognize that the opportunity here is immense and that we're not going to have commercialization for national security, tech transfer to national security, unless everybody has has buy-in to doing this and has the involvement, because these institutions matter. It's just an HBCU. No. This diversity of thought and the things that these universities are doing, that these students are doing, we need a national security level, period. That's it. There's no other conversation that really, we shouldn't have to have another conversation about it, but now there's a capacity issue. And how do we facilitate being able to provide that? Well, a lot of it is somebody listening to this right now is working for an organization that can help. So make sure you get in touch with us. Make sure you get in touch with Ty. Contact information will be in the block here. But this is an exciting time to be involved in this space. And I think now there has been that visibility where we're recognizing that it doesn't take much more to be able to do a lot. And this is one of these opportunities that's it's banging on the door, and we have to be there to open it.
Yeah. Again, it's a national priority, not just national security, which obviously is, but the amount, and this is for my friends that might be listening, that may have the connections to people who have access to capital. This is a capital intensive opportunity.
Yes. Right?
So the amount of money that's being left in those universities with those very smart folks who have very good ideas but can't crack the code is crazy. You know, I don't know, but I would suspect that's $500 billion a year that just gets left in there. I'm just making up that number.
Yeah, sitting on a shelf. There. Yeah.
Sitting on a shelf. In somebody's ears. I have an idea, but I can't find any funding for it, so I just have to go and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying. Yeah. Just saying.
And that is the reality. And I mean, if you think about with eight patents, with two people doing the work, imagine the support there that they would have if they had a comparable staffing and support as an organization that's putting out, that's generating just as much output. That's the prospect there is impressive.
I got one for you before we close, Jim.
You sound
and
good.
It's that same university, North Carolina A&T State University, was just announced that they are in partner with an organization called Wolfspeed makes silica carbide chips, microprocessors, part of the Chips and Science Act, right? They dropped $5 billion into the state of North Carolina. 4 weeks ago, it was announced that Wolfspeed is in conjunction, in partnership with North Carolina A&T, is going back to NIST, who is the executive agent through Commerce for that money, to build a plant on A&T's campus, clean room, building chips, right? Yeah. They didn't go to Stanford. They didn't go to Georgia Tech. They didn't go to MIT. They went to A&T and said, we believe it enough that we're going to actually put money in it. We're going to join them so they can now start building these chips. You can dollar get you a dime in their nanotechnology. Oh, by the way, they have a nanotechnology center, which probably producing a boatload of opportunity that are going to need somebody to help get that out. And by the way, it's happening all over the country.
Yes.
It's happening. All of these HBCUs are doing some kind of research, right? That school is going to need that kind of support. They're going to be able to produce some outstandingly brilliant technology that they're going to need to do this commercialization around.
Yeah. And this is, it's an exciting time. And I'm thinking it's great that we're seeing that these types of industries are recognizing the immense talent that's being brought into these institutions. And I'm also, again, very proud of Common Mission Project and the work that we're doing, because this is one of the most important pieces that we've recognized for as a society to move us forward is the broader inclusion of these great thinkers that have typically not had a voice at the table. So this, to me, is one of the most exciting times for us societally and also academically, because it's the getting out of the classroom experiences. It's the diversity of thought, it's diversity of background, and it's bringing these groups together to solve really immense problems and bring in immense opportunities to the doors of individuals who might not have had it otherwise. So Ty, to kind of close this out, any final thoughts or anything else here before we close out the episode?
I just appreciate the fact that you are carrying this torch, right? Telling this story, making space for a story that won't hear with me, that may not get heard in the spaces that we exist inside of. So when I start knocking on doors, people understand that it is not just me screaming, what does it say about Don Quixote, toiling against windmills?
Right, right.
That I'm actually thinking that this is not just a one-off, this is a series of opportunities. And so I really appreciate you giving me the space to have this conversation with you.
No, it's great. You're easily one of my favorite people. So to have you on as an episode here, it's fun anyways. And there's never a time when you and I have a conversation that I don't learn something. And I really appreciate the fact that you've taught me as much as you have with the patience and grace that you have, because again, we come from different backgrounds, but the one thing that Ty and I have been able to rally together among a lot of other things is the fact that we have this singular vision of what the future can look like. And that future involves us all working together, and not in a superficial way, in a very real personal way. So to me, the time that we've been working together has been, it just gets me excited about going into the classroom. It gets me excited to go to work. It gets me excited to work with young people that might not have had the opportunities they wouldn't have had if it wasn't for people like Ty, ringing the bell and saying, hey, listen, there are opportunities that you all need to pay attention to and get involved with. So I appreciate that immensely. You've changed the way that I think about things in such a positive way. So I can't thank you enough for not only just the collegiality, but our friendship. So thank you, Ty.
Hey, ain't no problem. Look, I'm broke as two dead dogs, but I got time. And I got one or two thoughts in my head that I'm willing to share.
Well, hey, thank you again. You'll find the information about the Common Mission Project in the description of this episode. But thank you for joining us. We hope that you enjoyed this, and we'll see you for the next episode. Thank you, Ty.
Very welcome.
Thank you again to the Common Mission Project for their support of this podcast. The Common Mission Project has demonstrated that students can tackle some of the toughest government problems, and in doing so, create vibrant, diverse ecosystems for government, academia, and industry, build partnerships around problems, prototypes, and solutions to urgent challenges facing our nation. To find out more about the Common Mission Project, please visit commonmission.us, which is linked in the description of this episode, as well as finding out options on how you can get more involved with our wonderful nonprofit organization, including opportunities to donate. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you on the next one.